Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. Today with us, we have Nikolai Ray, and we're going to talk prop tech. We're going to talk commercial real estate. We're going to talk a bunch of stuff. Nikolai, thank you so much for being with us today.
Ishai, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. You know what? Before we start digging into your story, which is pretty cool, I'm sure, and everybody wants to hear about, and we have so much to discuss about markets today, especially today with everything, the turmoil that's going on, and you know what happened after COVID, et cetera, and where is the market going today in the shifts? So many shifts. But beforehand, you know, give us a 2-minute elevator pitch of what you guys do today.
Absolutely. So I am first and foremost the CEO of MREX, which is a fintech in the multifamily real estate space. Essentially, what we're doing is we're trying to at least build the equivalent of a Bloomberg terminal, but for real estate investors, for small cap real estate investors, because there's a lot of data and intelligence that exists for mid-market and REITs and bigger players, but not really for, you know, kind of mom and pop investors and smaller investment companies. So we're building that. I also teach at the MREX College, which is our educational institute. I teach real estate financial engineering. I've been teaching that for about 5 years now. Throughout that as well, I am myself a real estate investor and developer. I have a fully vertically integrated real estate investment firm and general contractor, where what we do is very heavy value add and opportunistic stuff. So we've purchased about 40 apartment buildings in the last 24 months. We have another 10 under contract at the moment. We do about probably $15 to $20 to $25 million in renovations and construction work a year, just on our own properties. This is not syndicated. This is our own money. This it's a private entity, if you may. And that's pretty much it. In a couple of minutes, I have a very eclectic background. I've been doing real estate for over 10 years. Actually, built and sold a very small boutique real estate investment bank. And been all around the world. I'm in Montreal right now because of COVID, but spent a lot of time as well in Miami and the rest of Florida. So,
I think you gave me like 3 days on a row of conversation right now, just by saying what you said. So this is exciting to say the least, and I can't wait. But you know what? Before we even start, you know, everybody likes to. We just spoke about this right before, you know, we started. A lot of people want to hear, okay, the guy is telling me he's in the game of real estate. And, you know, you have people who didn't start. I have a lot of listeners who are professionals, who are savvy people, whether they are on the landlord, owner part, CEO. They could also be on the side of brokerage, whether it's finance brokers or deal brokers, doesn't matter. You know, all kind of professionals. And you have also beginners. And everybody gets inspiration from how you got into this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there are a couple of ways that I got into this, especially where I am at now. I think initially where I kind of got the bug was a couple of my buddies were buying a small apartment building, it was a fiveplex back when I was, you know, late teens, early 20s. And I was actually a professional hockey player for a couple of years. So I had a bit of money and they needed help with the down payment. So I said, okay, well, you know, I'm rather than just you know, waste my money on bars and girls, you know, why not put it into an apartment building, right? And I grew up pretty poor. So I had learned myself through reading books as a teenager about kind of, you know, the whole concept of assets versus liabilities and stuff like that. So I was already kind of on that mental pathway of trying to not live like my parents lived and do better for myself financially. So did that. That's kind of how I got started. It got me, you know, to kind of have to learn how to underwrite. And I was already a very mathematically savvy human being, if you may. I was probably doing, you know, college level math when I was in fourth grade, just naturally. I've always been really good at math. I think that's my Indian origins. My grandfather was Bengali from the northeast of India. So everyone there is either an engineer or a doctor. Wow. And really good at math. So it's probably where it comes from. But essentially, that's how I got into it personally. But I didn't really do much after that until my mid to late 20s, when I started an investment banking firm in the real estate sector. And that had me working mostly as a professional, well, entirely as a professional, in capital markets and transaction and advisory services, financial modeling for very wealthy families, high net worth individuals, private equity firms, and syndicators. And I sold that in 2016. So that was kind of my professional side of things. And then 2 years ago, actually 2.5 years ago, I decided to get back in the game personally and kind of try and repeat the success I had as a professional in the real estate financial engineering space and try and repeat that as an investor, because I'd done all this work for all these wealthy families, for all these syndications, for all these investors, and helped them, you know, really build their portfolios. But I didn't really have any real estate assets to show. And because I was spending, you know, 12 to 14 to 16 hours a day working on these things and building this investment banking firm, well, I mean, the little free time I had left, I didn't really want to spend it investing in real estate for all those years. So now that I'd sold that, I now had, you know, some free time to actually say, hey, maybe I can start, you know, maybe I can repeat what I did for others for myself.
That's an amazing story. Nicole, let me ask you this. How old are you, if I may ask?
I'm 37, going on 38.
All right. Good age. Let me just get the clarity of it. You started a real estate investment banking firm or an investment banking firm?
Real estate investment.
So, real estate investment banking firm. Yeah, and yeah. I could relate to that because I was the head of real estate investment banking at a big firm. And I know what it takes. It's a lot of work. And
it is.
What I want to know is you started on your, you had the idea on your own to start it and then you went to start it?
So to give you a bit of a backstory, I played professional hockey till the age of 22 when I retired. I played a couple of years professionally and semi-professionally. And I had a degree in biomechanics with a minor in nutrition, sports nutrition actually. And I did my postgrad in preventive medicine, specializing in health psychology. So that brought me to, in my early 20s after my hockey career, work in rehabilitation with very big insurance companies, and also work with high level athletes because I had that athletic background and I had that knowledge base. So I actually ended up going to the Olympics 3 times as the chief of human performance for some of the Canadian Olympic teams, especially in biathlon, which is skiing and shooting. And that was my 20s. But throughout that, I had built a business around that skill set and that expertise. And that business did very, very well and then ended up not doing so well. And when it ended up not doing so well, that really brought me kind of to an existential crisis of reflecting upon what I wanted to truly do with my skills and with my time and my energy. And I realized that I'd only gone into that field despite all the success I had. I mean, I was having, you know, in the human performance field, I was having as much success as someone would aspire to have, you know, in their 40s, 50s, and even 60s. I was very, very quick to have a lot of success, but it wasn't satisfying. I found it actually quite boring, and I wasn't motivated by it. So I kept on saying to myself, well, there's something weird here. Like, that's not normal that I'm, you know, at the peak of this field at such a young age, but yet just not feeling it. And I've never been really driven by, you know, material things and stuff like that. So I've always been driven by trying to find my purpose and trying to be as valuable as a human being as possible. you know, be it through entrepreneurship or be it through just my own personal relationships or through philanthropy and stuff like that. So my realization was I really love math. That's why I went into biomechanics, but I was tired of sports and human performance and stuff like that. I'd only kind of gone into that, I guess, to soften the blow from the end of my athletic career. And I realized that I always really had this big passion for finance and especially real estate because of the tangible aspect of it. And then I had a very fortunate meeting with a guy who was already in the brokerage field and the capital markets field. And we hit it off. And the entrepreneur in me and the math guy in me who had a bit of real estate experience was like, hey, there's an underserved segment of the market here in real estate where you have real estate brokers, you have mortgage brokers, but there's no one really doing any financial modeling for smaller real estate firms. There's no one really doing any true capital market stuff. And that's when I proposed to him. I said, hey, what do you think of this idea? And he was like, wow, that's a great idea. So, you know, we just kind of went from there and said, hey, let's do it. And, you know, being the pure entrepreneur, like you said, you know, I mean, at first it was 16 to 18 hour days. You know, I ended up in order to make a name for that business and also to be able to have a strong enough proficiency level to build that business, I ended up personally analyzing by hand over $10 billion of small cap multifamily transactions. That's one by one looking at everything that transacted, 5-unit apartment buildings, 25-unit apartment buildings, 100-unit apartment buildings, pulling out the NOI of each property, calculating the performance. Cap rates. it's 10,000 hours of performance, essentially. You know, that's essentially what it is. That's how I really got into real estate.
That's an amazing story. How many people, meaning you started with obviously you and your friend, when you sold the company, how many years it took to sell it?
Three and a half. Okay. 3.5 years. And we had a staff of somewhere between 10 to 15.
Nice. Beautiful. Yep. Wow. Yep. Very, very nice. And which markets you guys focused on?
We focused on the province of Quebec, so essentially Montreal, Quebec City, and the other markets around there.
Beautiful, a market that I don't know much, but I'm sure it's exciting.
Beautiful place. It's actually the Canadian capital of multifamily. A lot of people think that Toronto or Vancouver would be the most important multifamily markets, but Montreal actually is, just because of culturally, there are a lot of apartment buildings in the province of Quebec. And a lot of tenants.
That's amazing. So you sold that company, and then you started doing things on your own. Obviously, what was the next step? Where did you get into?
So I sold that company initially, essentially because I didn't see eye to eye with my business partner. He was happy making, you know, $200,000-$400,000 a year, and you know, just like keeping it at that. Whereas I'm a builder, I like, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm an ID, I'm an innovator. I like building cool stuff and stuff that's different. So for me, that wasn't, you know, for him, that was like, oh, we achieved. And I was like, no, we're just getting started. Like, that's not what I want necessarily. And as I was building the firm, I kept on hitting my head against a couple of very similar problems. And the number one problem was I felt like there wasn't much access or transparency to data in the small cap multifamily market. So anything under, say, 50 to 100 units. So from 5 to 50 or 100 units, there's not much data. Like over 100 units, there's a lot of data. You have CoStars and Reonomies and all this stuff. But under that, there's not that much data, number one. Number two, I kept on coming back to the thought of, why is it that there's no centralized marketplace? Why is it that If I have $300,000 to invest in multifamily real estate today, and I'm not a real estate expert, and you know, I don't want to become one, why is it that I can't just go somewhere and see all the inventory and make, you know, a decent decision? Why is it I have to go through all these hurdles and loops, and you know, have to go on Zillow and LoopNet and 10X and Crexie and then off market and then onto all the brokerages, the big brokerages and wholesalers? Like, why is it that it's so complicated to get access to the market? if you're not an insider, you know, despite this being such an important asset class. And that's kind of where the idea of like kind of a Bloomberg Terminal slash, you know, Expedia or Zillow multifamily came into mind. So that all came together. And I'm just like, you know what? I told my business partner, listen, I'll sell you and the first three employees my half of the business. I'm going to go and build something else. And that's when I went off and started the MREX. So initially I wanted to build this technology platform. And as I started building the technology platform, I started posting on Facebook and on social media, just my daily thoughts. Because there was a 6 month period where I was essentially retired, where I couldn't start another business until my sale of the first one closed. So I was in my, you know, early 30s with not much to do. So I just started, you know, kind of thinking and sharing my thoughts on social media, which was not a thing really back then, especially not in Canada, maybe a bit more so in the US. And that just turned into the realization that, wow, there was a big discrepancy in the education in the market. So if you want to learn how to invest in multifamily, or if you want to learn how to invest and perform what I call, you know, searching for alpha, well, there's a big discrepancy, because on one side of the market, you have all these gurus and the seminars and the conferences and the coaches. And I don't say that in a bad way whatsoever. I think a lot of them are doing a great job, but it's very on the surface. It's not always 100% objective. And then on the other side, you have colleges and universities. But I mean, if you decide that, you know, tomorrow morning you want to start investing in multifamily real estate, you know, unless you have a degree in finance already, you're not going to go back to college or university to do a degree in finance or in real estate development. And anyway, that's probably better to get a job, whereas it's not suited to become an investor. And then if you do go to the coaching conferences and seminars and stuff like that, well, like I said, a lot of it's very kind of introductory or superficial, and it doesn't have that more, you know, academic or theoretical or scientific base behind it. And so I started on the side of my technology company, an educational institute, essentially. And that was that transition period.
That's an amazing thing. And as a guy who made also an online course about not multifamily, but commercial real estate, takes one to know one. And it sounds like you have so much to give to others, which is incredible. But I would like to divide everything that you just poured on us to three sections, okay? To make it more, I would say, educational or informative for everybody who's listening.
Absolutely.
One part, and we're talking about what you do today, okay? And one is the real estate part, which we're going to talk about right now, what you're involved in, what type of deals, how you're getting into deals. Are you more on the LP private equity side or the general partner side or both? Or what do you do? That's one conversation. I would like to get into that. The second conversation, which we're going to have, I would like to talk about the prop tech side of things. That would be the next, when we shift gears, we're going to talk about that. I would like to make it about that and to dig in about this, about what you wanted to do as the Bloomberg terminal for, you know, the small cap multifamily sector, as you called it. And the third part I would like to talk about is the educational part, of course. I'll leave that to the end, but and that is exciting. So let's start, first of all, about what you do today in terms of real estate. What type of deals? What role are you playing? Are you a general partner? Are you more on the private equity side looking for sponsors? Where are you with that? And type of deal size, you know, et cetera, locations?
Pretty simple, actually. Like so me and two buddies invest together. So one is an engineer, and he's a general contractor. He has his general contractor license. And the other is essentially a doctor, a radiologist. So
what a combination.
Yep. So we're three
buddies.
One
is a financial guy. One is an engineer, construction guy. And the third guy can just see through everybody.
Exactly. It's a good partnership. So we just started essentially a joint venture partnership between the three of us. And it started with, hey, I had a deal on a 7-unit apartment building. And well, it was kind of a joke. My buddy was the broker who had listed the property. So I sent an LOI to just kind of, you know, play around with him. And this was about 2.5 years, a bit less than 2.5 years ago. So ended up going through the whole process. And I got to the point where it was too late to drop the LOI because I didn't want him to look like an idiot. I didn't want to look like an idiot towards my buddy. And these two guys, my buddy engineer and my buddy doctor, well, the engineer was actually one of my students. So I actually taught to him. I taught him real estate financial engineering and analysis and modeling. So that's how we met, but we kind of kicked it off. And I'm not a manual person, so I needed someone who could, you know, do the heavy lifting and the actual construction work. So I knew that if I did eventually buy my own properties, it would probably be with him, because I wanted to kind of, you know, leverage that kind of aspect of things. And then my doctor buddy had always told me, hey, if you invest in real estate, let me know, I'm in. So gave them both a call, ended up buying the 7-unit apartment building together. We paid, it was essentially a crack house. So it was across the street from an elementary school, from a grade school. And one of the apartments was essentially a crack house where you had these Nepalese immigrants selling crack cocaine out of their apartment.
Wow.
So it was a pretty rough like apartment building, but it had good bones. So what we did is we ended up paying about $420,000, which was not a lot, but it was a rundown apartment building. And we ended up putting about $700,000 in renovations in the property within, you know, a 4-month span. So we essentially, you know, got all the tenants out of the apartments, and then just obviously stripped the whole property, redid everything, plumbing, electricity, divisions, insulation, everything that you can think of, we pretty much
you just it. Kept the frame. That's how it sounds.
Kept the frame and the foundation. That was it. So yeah. and then we refied out of that, made a nice profit. And as we were doing this, well, my other broker buddy is like, hey, you're buying apartments now? And I'm like, yeah. So he sends me an off-market deal that was an even sweeter deal, a 10-unit apartment building that had just been bought out of bankruptcy. So we paid $550,000 for that. We only had to put $50,000 down because the seller actually financed us the other $490,000 or $500,000 on the property. And that's a property that we just finished renovating a couple months ago. We put about $1.3 million into it. And now it's worth almost $3 million. So same kind of thing. We just redid absolutely everything. And essentially we've done that now. So we've purchased in the last 26 months or so, I guess, 40 of those types of deals, pretty much.
Wow.
So we've done 40 of those types of deals.
10 units, 15 units, that kind of stuff.
5 to 12 units.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we also buy stuff like maybe a triplex, but that the zoning allows for the construction of a 12 unit. So we'll knock down the 3-unit. We'll build a 12 unit on that instead.
We you also have to rezone also? You went to rezoning also?
Yeah, we rezone.
How is the process in that area in terms of rezoning? So, how long it takes?
So what I try and do is most of the time I'll try and actually just arbitrage off the actual zoning laws. So if the zone is zone 12 units, I'll look for all the houses and duplexes and triplexes in that zone. And then it's not that hard of a process because it's already zone 12 units.
Right.
It's just that it wasn't built properly. You know,
right. Someone it gets built the house permits. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Whereas one of the deals that we're building right now is we bought a warehouse. And we went through the whole rezoning process of that warehouse property. And we ended up knocking that down. And now we're building 8 6-unit apartment buildings. So 48 units, essentially. On a deal that we paid, you know, we paid $225,000 for that warehouse. I mean, just the land now is worth about $1.3 million just because we were able to rezone it.
So basically what you do is you take your own money. You don't syndicate much. You take you, a few other partners, and that's it. You go, you get, I get. I guess you get take some bank financing. What's your leverage usually?
So we use a mix. So most of the money, I'd say probably up until the first 25 deals was all our money. And then I believe at around maybe deal 25 or 30, we took on three friends. So each friend maybe put some money in one deal, one put in another deal, one put in another two or three deals. But essentially, you know, we own about 90% of our properties. We own about 90% of the equity. And then we use, you know, either bridge financing, hard money lenders. We've used a lot of seller financing as well. So
then various,
and then we refi out of that. So, you know, we're essentially leveraging anything, anywhere between, you know, sometimes we'll leverage zero. Like we buy some properties cash.
Wow.
And put zero leverage on it just because we know we're going to knock it down and then build up something. Other properties we leverage up to 100%. So it's, I'd say the average is probably around maybe 65 to 75, 80-ish. And then
not
once
bad
we
at all.
Refi, no, not bad at all. And then once we very refi, good. I mean, we have properties that we have, you know, less than 50% leverage on them.
First of all, it's very interesting. I think that your method is exciting. And it's, I think it gives people hope that you don't always need to go leverage out, get LPs, et cetera, which is a beautiful system, obviously, to go and raise capital of other people. But some people do have the money and they're so lost. And by taking one or two or three partners, you're done. You don't need to take much. You don't need to do much. You're basically in a good shape. And that's, I think, that's beautiful. The next thing I would like to discuss is your fintech, obviously, your exciting company that you got involved with. And and we understand why you got involved with it, but I have so many questions about it. So if you could, first of all, elaborate about it, and then I'll take the questions from there. You know, the concept, if you could like remind us what we spoke about a second ago, the Bloomberg terminal concept for small cap properties.
Yep. And if you don't mind, before we jump to that, actually what you just said made me think about something that I think is not talked about enough. Like how you said that you don't necessarily have to syndicate, because I think right now in real estate, the whole syndication model is very popular, right? Everyone in their grandmother is syndicating right now, right?
Yes.
And everyone's a syndicator. And I get it, right? Because it's a great way to get fees and essentially live off of real estate, even though you don't have maybe enough equity placed in real estate to live off of your own cash flow, right? So
yes,
it's a great way to kind of get out of your W-2 job and do that. But it's also essentially a business and a job, right? And you're replacing your W-2 by another job. You're just now working for yourself and essentially while you're working for your investors, which is a good thing. I have no problem with that. I have no quarrel with that whatsoever. But I think a lot of people get caught up in the fact that they have to do all these big deals and raise all this big money. And I think most people getting started out in real estate, if they just want to get started out and they don't want to be an LP, or they want to be an active investor, but they don't want to start having to raise all this money and do all these big deals. You know, there's no shame in buying a 5-unit apartment building, or there's a loan, or there's no shame in buying an 8-unit with a friend or with another person and doing a small joint venture.
100%.
I think there's no shame in that whatsoever. And I think it's actually a great way to learn and a great way to apply what you're learning maybe in courses, apply it, get that experience, and be a better syndicator if you do wish to syndicate eventually.
Because you have experience with the actual deal.
Of course. I mean, if tomorrow morning I wanted to syndicate, I mean, it'd be a walk in the park, because I'm going to LPs and I'm saying, hey, I'm syndicating this 400 unit apartment building. Do you want to get into my syndication? Okay, who are you? Well, you know, apart from, you know, my resume and all that stuff, well, I've bought 40 apartment buildings in the last 24 months with my own money, and I've turned them all around. That's a powerful thing. And that's
very powerful.
That's an extreme. But I mean,
right?
let's take two people who, well, what's your experience? Well, I've never done any real estate. I've just done a coaching or gone through a seminar, versus, well, I already own a 5-unit that I've had for 2 years, or, you know, I own 3 or 4, you know, quadruplexes or 6 or 8 units, and I've done a good job managing them. Well, hey, that's a good base to go off of, right?
It just teaches us that there's so many ways to get into this business. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. So on the fintech side of things, as you asked, so what we've done so far is we've built a mobile app that essentially is essentially doing two things at the moment. What it does is it's centralized all apartment buildings into one place.
In a certain location in Quebec, or is it?
So for now, what we've done is we've used kind of the beta in the province of Quebec. So what we've done is we've essentially aggregated, there's about 60,000 apartment buildings of 5 units and plus in the province, which for Americans, the province is essentially the state. So just imagine, whenever I say province, I'm saying state.
Okay.
But Essentially, in the state, there's about 60,000 apartment buildings. So what we've done is we've aggregated all the 60,000 apartment buildings into a database. And then we've gone and got data from a whole bunch of different sources and created a unique database. And what we've done from that is we've created essentially a search engine that you can enter an address and search for a property, or you can go on the map and just search for apartment buildings.
Whether just like they're on sale. CoStar, or like you said, Reonomy, or et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right.
And but for those properties, yeah.
Rather they're, and if they're on sale or they're not on sale, you can still find the properties and you can find all the information. And then we apply all our models onto those properties to help, number one, do a first level of underwriting for you. So you don't have to be a strong underwriter to already kind of see how this property, you know, what's the potential of this property? How could I purchase this property? What are the different scenarios? And kind of like how various platforms offer signals to investors in the stock market, be it like Motley Fool or Real Vision or those platforms, Hedgeye and stuff like that. So we're essentially already doing some of the legwork for investors. And then if you are more of a sophisticated investor, you can actually just pull the data from there directly into the second screen of the app. And then you have your full underwriting tool that allows you to actually start model your acquisition.
So let me ask you this. Are you guys actually going property by property and putting the data, or do you have an AI system that takes the known data or whatever you guys put together and that sort of calculates into the pro forma?
Well, so I mean, AI is kind of a buzzword that's thrown around a lot, but yes, there is
automatic. Let's call it automatic.
Yeah. There's machine learning or deep learning.
Machine learning. Yes. Best.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's very good, because, you know, going through each and every one of those and do that, that's very, very difficult. But if the machine learning process is taking those fairly simple, properties to digest, you know, and take right. them and put the number out, that's brilliant, especially for people who look at their property, those properties, and many of them are not that savvy. So that's, I think this is a great idea.
Absolutely.
You know what reminds me? There's another a company, actually an Israeli-based company that raised a lot of capital, and they're very successful. Skyline, I think, AI. I think that's
right, the name. Right.
So that's is that similar to that concept or less?
No,
because more due diligence-y type of...
Well, less so. What they are is essentially a real estate fund that's powered by AI, right? So what they're doing is they're using AI or deep learning, essentially, to try and find discrepancies in value in various markets or properties, acquire those properties for their fund, and deliver alpha to their investors, right?
I see.
Whereas what we're doing is we're trying to be the market, essentially. We're
right.
trying to
you give information.
Right. We're creating a marketplace where we're educating or informing everyday investors. So we're not actually, you know, buying properties or stuff like that.
That's beautiful. Tell me something. Why would it take for that type of terminal? And I'm sure you have some competitors. I'm not that familiar, but I'm trying to think if I know of any, or, you know, et cetera. But what would it take to go into the United States of America and do it, let's say, in the New York area, which is very difficult to do that?
Essentially, just time and money. So that's actually a great question. So when I started this business, I started with my own capital. I didn't raise any money from angel investors, didn't do a seed round, nothing. Like, there's zero outside capital in this company. And essentially...
This is amazing.
Yeah. And essentially what happens is that the infrastructure is there in place for the U.S. This startup's been built for the U.S. and Canada, essentially. So it's just a question of starting to go and pull the data sources and build our own database for the U.S. That's all that's really missing for that. Which is essentially capital. But before raising capital, I wanted to make sure that there was a functioning product, essentially, and that there's product market fit, and that it's doable and scalable, essentially. So right. essentially, all that would be missing is that raise a couple million and throw that into data acquisition, and the machine's already there to swallow all that data up, and then put it into and then create our own unique database with that. So. That's essentially the model. And because it's very niche, it's a niche product, And I'm a very long-term type of entrepreneur where I'm not looking to get rich quick, or, I mean, I'm already more than well off. You know, I could stop tomorrow morning. I'm good for the rest of my life. So I'm very into building things the way I want to build them and creating value through those things. And I'm not in a rush.
Which is beautiful.
So there are indirect competitors. Reonomy might be considered an indirect competitor. Obviously, CoStars and Zillow's and all this. But I think we put too much value on competitors because a lot of people just copy what everyone else is doing. But I think you're able to have competitors, but do something so unique that there is an avatar or type of user that no matter the existence of CoStar or Reonomy or LoopNet or whatever the other types of things that exist out there, there's a whole bunch of, you know, fintech companies in the real estate space. If what you're building attacks a very specific problem in a very applicable way, you're good.
Tell me something. What type of staff do you have in your business?
So we have a CTO who's obviously a very, very high level engineer with a lot of leadership. We have a full-time CFO who is actually the chief innovation officer for Canada's equivalent of Fannie Mae.
Oh,
so
wow.
very high level person, a PhD with a whole bunch of postdocs in economy. And obviously myself. And then we have UX team, so UX designers. And then we have all the programming team. So we have back-end engineers, front-end engineers, and then the data guys. So we have
how
about
many
a
people?
Team of about 10.
Good. Sounds like you're going somewhere, please God. And it sounds like this is, you got something there. Sounds like you got something there. Obviously, you know, that type of business, in order to scale, just like you said, once you have a good system going, once you have a good, I would say, flow, and you know how it works, and you can copycat this whole system to another place, all it takes is capital. And
absolutely.
Once you know what type of capital you need for each location, obviously, the United States, you know, different capital is required for Omaha and New York, obviously.
Right. But, absolutely.
But that's what you will need. I mean, that's what you'll need. Some places you'll be able to still run things from Canada. In some places you'll need a hub. And, that's the way it is. But it sounds like such an exciting idea, especially for people who want to get into the smaller deals. I think this is a blessed thing and beautiful. And I wish you all, you know, all the best with that. That sounds amazing.
Thank you.
Sounds amazing. And you know what? And everybody who's listening, by the way, you guys are you know, every once in a while I get someone who is involved in prop tech, and here you see Nikolai is doing something really, really exciting. And you know what? Sometimes all it takes is to jump in. You listen to a podcast and you connect with someone and you take an opportunity. Sometimes that's all it takes. And that sounds like a beautiful idea. You know what? I want to shift gears a little bit and go to the educational part of things. Okay. And you know what? Before we go to the educational part of things, pause. Let's pause it for a second. We'll talk about it in a second. I want to ask you something general about the markets, you know, and what's going on in the markets. Where do you think we're going today? And let's discuss mostly, meaning no crystal ball, you know, nobody holds it. But where do you think we're holding today? And you are a multifamily guy. So, you know, it's such a crazy time today, such crazy times today. And we talk more about this, but I would like to get the ball rolling and give you that, you know, that ability to talk about that.
Well, I'm a multifamily guy, and obviously I'm an entrepreneur, and I guess now you could kind of say I'm a tech guy, but I mean, at heart, I'm a finance guy, right? I love finance. So obviously, I also like economics, especially macroeconomics. So I wouldn't say, I'd never consider myself an economist, but I don't know, I'd want to be one.
You know what? I'll tell you one thing. As a guy who watches constantly, and I'm not an economist and I'm not a finance guy, but I know finance.
Yeah.
And especially meaning real estate finance, obviously. And I can tell you this much. I'm a guy who constantly researches. I made a research about the Great Depression and a lot of research about the 2008 recession. what one went on. I watched a lot of movies about this and a lot of details about this and read a lot of material to make sure I understand the flow of how things got collapsed.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. And obviously this was very, very different than, you know, what went on during COVID, because this was not a real estate driven problem. This was a totally different issue. But we are in a situation today where cap rates are going lower and lower and lower. Obviously, multifamily is the most resilient asset class. But within that asset class, you have different type of classes and different type of thought process and different type of type of deals, whether it's more value add, more, you know, core plus, whatever you call it, different approaches. And that's what I want to, you know, as a finance guy, what is your take on that?
Well, and not to throw tomatoes at my economist friends, because I have a lot of economist friends and I have a lot of respect for them. But I think us finance people are a bit more kind of mathematical and a bit less abstract. But essentially, the way I see it is, I think cap rates are going to hold even if interest rates rise. Now, do I think interest rates will rise in the short term? I think obviously what the Fed is looking to do, interest rates will probably rise. And I don't like to say things as absolute. I think it's all a game of probabilities, but I think they will probably rise. I think it's a mistake. I personally think that the Fed shouldn't raise rates. And I think it will be very short-lived. I think the minute that they raise rates, one, two, now they're talking about even three times, I think. I think what's going to happen is that the markets are going to react very, very negatively. And the reason being is I think we're actually, inflation's not really the problem. I think deflation is the problem. You know, we're still in the same euro dollar shortage that we've been in since 2007. And for people who don't know what the euro dollar is, this essentially is American dollars parked in banks outside of the US, right? That's essentially how the economy works. There's still a shortage of dollars, and that's not going anywhere, and it hasn't been fixed. And the Federal Reserve and all the central banks printing money, they don't actually print money, right? The Fed doesn't print money. What they do is they essentially create reserves, which then they trade to banks for treasuries. And normally, in the way the system was supposed to work through quantitative easing is that these commercial banks would, you know, essentially take that and make out more loans, right? And do more loans. And that's how you create money essentially in the market. But what they've only been doing is essentially buying more treasuries and selling them, trading them back to the Fed for more reserves. So there's not actually any real money creation despite all this quantitative easing. Now, that's why I think essentially deflation is probably what we should be worried about in the mid to long term, much more so than inflation. Now, I don't have a crystal ball, like we said, and you know, I'm just a finance and real estate dude, right? So what the hell do I know? Either way, I think multifamily is a very good asset class to be in. You got to be in any asset class anyway, whether you're in deflation, inflation, whatever. You know, an investor is invested. You can't sit on the sidelines. And I think the one thing to keep in mind is, despite all that's going on the macroeconomic side and even in microeconomics, the one thing that you have to keep in mind as an investor is, hey, as long as you can service your debt, you can ride out pretty much any storm. So watch your leverage levels, and especially watch your DCF.
Most important levels. Thing.
Right. Watch your DSR levels, debt service ratios. And if you can protect your cash flows at that level, well, you're protecting yourself against most of that risk, right? And then, you know, well, whatever happens to the market, well, then that's a crapshoot, essentially.
Obviously, and what you said is very, very interesting. You said that we have to worry more about deflation. Right now, there's inflation going on. That's without right. a doubt. That's right now what we see.
Right.
In order because to understand...
Because of supply chains and because of helicopter money, right?
Of course. The helicopter money is, I think, one of the things that everybody loves, but at the same time, it's one of the biggest mistakes in terms of how to use money. It was necessary in the very beginning. It was necessary maybe even later, but at a certain point, you got to know when to stop it. It would keep people from going back to work. It would keep people from doing the right thing. from investing correctly, or it will keep, you know, it's good when the markets are frozen, when the pandemic hit and nobody knew where we're going, and et cetera. But you obviously have to know where you're going. And the inflation is caused by that. Deflation obviously is what we, you know, this is like the main term when it happens, that the market is basically going down and down and down and down and down and down and down, where, you know, a depression can come about, you know, when or something really extreme can come about. And the yeah, go ahead.
I think a lot of people get inflation and deflation, all these things. And these are terms that are used very loosely, right? So it's hard to, you know, if you take an Austrian economics view of things, you'd say, you know, kind of like the Peter Schiff, you know, the gold guy who's like, you know, it's inflated because, you know, essentially they've deflated the value of the dollar because they've printed so much money, blah, blah, blah. And then you can look at the stock market and say, well, we're going through inflation. Most people will look at consumer price indexes and, you know, how much gas costs, how much food costs, how much rent costs, right? That's what inflation is to a lot of people. Now, I'm not saying there's not inflation on assets, not saying that whatsoever, but I think the inflation on goods is transitory. I'm gonna stick with that, even though Jerome Powell hasn't stuck with that. I think it is transitory. And I think—
Can you explain that? It's transitory in terms of what?
Well, I think it's because of supply chain issues and because, you know, helicopter money was dropped on people. But the minute, you know, the supply chain issues ease and come back to normal, the minute that people actually have to go back to work, well, that inflation will have been transitory. And we're not going to keep on seeing 4, 5, 6% year-on-year inflation, because you have to remember that means that next year we're going to have another 4 or 5% over the 4 or 5% that we've already had. Like that's, I don't see that happening. I don't see that. I think GDP is nowhere near it should be. I think GDP over the last 10, 12 years has actually not grown as much as it should be. And if there's no GDP growth, where the hell is the inflation coming from? Like I said, the banks aren't, you know, they're not really printing money. They're just playing this kind of, you know, risk management, risk aversion retrade game with, you know, with the Fed and with central banks. And there hasn't really been that much money creation in the system, and especially money creation going towards growth, GDP, right?
So you're saying basically that what we see today is going to adjust itself basically and fix itself, obviously.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, that's an approach. But the one thing I love what you said, inflation is as bad as it is, and it is bad, without a doubt. It is bad. Things that aren't stable are bad, whether they're on this side or that side. But inflation is bad because, like you said, every consumer good is going up and up. And it's, you know, this costs more, gas costs more, everything costs more. Deflation presents in the very end of it, the very extreme end of it, no milk in the store. And that is like the very extreme part of it, I guess. But, you know, going back to what we spoke about in markets and real estate, et cetera, I think that, you know, today's environment, obviously, and that's why I talk about it a lot, that the multifamily was affected mostly by, you know, the office, residential are basically correlated. The less office, more residential, more housing, in terms of more larger homes, more square footage on the homes, more single family homes, more suburbia, et cetera, like that, or more, I would say, suburban office, less urban office, et cetera, that will change again. Meaning people will go back to the cities. It's a matter of time, but that was affected. And on the other side, you have the retail industrial, you know, less square footage on the retail, more, you know, in terms of industrial and, you know, distribution centers, et cetera, because of the e-commerce revolution. So that's what I think.
And on the multifamily space, you have to understand that cap rates, and this is a big fallacy that a lot of people believe, that cap rates are driven by interest rates, which is not true. Like all the research shows, all the studies that have been done on this show that interest rates do not drive cap rates. yes, in the mid to long term, they influence cap rates, but they don't drive cap rates. What drive cap rates is movement of capital. Basic economics 101, supply and demand. How right. much money is searching for deals, right? So even if interest rates do rise in the next year, if there's still the same amount of money searching for the same amount of properties,
cap rates will go down.
Cap rates will go down. Well, at least they'll stay the same. They won't be going up, right?
Right, right.
So obviously, if interest rates rise, you know, by 200-300% and stay there for 4 or 5 years, you know,
yeah, it'll drive people off.
It will influence the market, but interest rates don't drive cap rates, and I think that's one thing people have to really keep in mind.
Love that perspective. I want to shift gears a little bit, and before we set our goodbyes, talk a little bit about your educational system.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Essentially, what it was, like I said, is I was talking a lot about, you know, various ways to manage risk or maximize returns in multifamily, searching for alpha, but, you know, without, you know, actual alpha, because I think a lot of people mistake alpha where they're like, well, he's getting more returns, he's generating more profits, so he's generating alpha. That's not true. It has to be risk adjusted, right? If you're taking, 20% more risk to generate 20% more returns, you're not really doing better than the other person, right?
Right.
You're just taking more risk, and thus you're getting the equivalent higher returns for the risk. So just as I was talking about this stuff and all these various theories that relate to real estate financial engineering, and what real estate financial engineering is essentially the umbrella under which, you know, everything that's mathematical that you use to find a solution to a problem in real estate essentially is real estate financial engineering, right? Underwriting, modeling, those are all parts of real estate financial engineering. So as I said, I saw that in the market there were coaching programs and seminars, which are very, you know, practical, introductory, motivational, but they don't go very deep into the mathematics and the analysis and the actual kind of science of real estate investing. And then obviously on the other side of the spectrum, well, colleges and universities. But I mean, unless you want to become an appraiser or an investment banker, you know, no multifamily investor is going to go back to school, back to college to do a degree. So I figured, hey, let's build something in the middle where you have, you know, university level pedagogy and education, but in a very applied manner and very specific manner to real estate investors of all backgrounds, whether you have a degree in finance or whether you have your grade 12, how can we teach you to be a better real estate investor? And that's kind of the genesis of the MREX College, which is we're bringing you, you know, university level and quality education to everyday mom and pop investors in the small cap to mid-market level.
Beautiful. So you guys heard it. You know what? You want to learn about multifamily? You want to get into this whole arena? You got Nikolai's College and you can learn more about it. You know what? Before we say our goodbyes, first of all, I want to tell you that I enjoyed this interview really very much. And I'm sure everybody who's listening to us is really enjoying it. And thank you for this.
You're making me realize how busy I am. Like, talking about all this stuff, like, geez, I need.
That's
to
how it is. You know, people don't realize how involved they are in certain things until they actually start elaborating. Tell us how people can find you, whether it's for the university, for the education, or if they eventually want to invest with you, or want to learn about you more, or connect with you. Tell us a little bit.
I'm on all social media, so be it Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok, so whatever is your favorite poison, I'd say go for it. I also recently started my YouTube channel. I actually have a vlog. I've already done a couple of episodes where I have someone follow me around in my real estate investing, my actual properties.
So that's amazing.
Cool. Yeah, that's pretty cool to see. It's called Alpha Investor. And obviously the MREX College, same thing. You can go to mrex.co. You can follow MREX College on all the various social media platforms. We produce a lot of content. I share a lot on social media as much as I can, obviously being a very busy person and not being a full-time social media influencer, but actually being someone who's in the trenches. So yeah, that's probably the best way to get in touch with me and see what's going on.
Beautiful. And you guys can see the links above, below, and you can go and learn more about Nikolai. This was really exciting. Nikolai, thank you very much.
Thank you, Yishai. Appreciate it.
No problem. You guys, I'm going to see you in the next show. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.